It's 9:30.
It is. You're right.
Yeah.
Let her rip.
Okay. We're going to call the meeting of the Climate Protection Committee to order.
On the roll for the Climate Protection Committee meeting of April 22nd, 2019, Director Haggerty, yeah. Director Kim, Director Nis, Director Ronan, Director... Director Ross, yeah. Director Wagon Connect, Director Wilson, Director Zane.
Here.
Committee Vice Chair Joya.
Here.
Committee Chair Barrett.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. Can we have the Pledge of Allegiance? Public comment on non-agendized items. Are there any cards? Seeing no one rise, we'll move on to approval of the minutes of September 20th. Motion by Haggerty.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
That's unanimously passed. Update on the methane strategy rule development efforts.
Good morning, Chair Barrett and members of the committee. I'm going to introduce this item today. As you recall, we've been working on our methane strategy for a couple of years, and the idea was to come up with a comprehensive strategy to address this highly impactful climate pollutant. One of the changes that we've made in this strategy recently that I want to bring to your attention today is that we had spent a long time working on a general prohibition on significant methane releases. We call this our backstop rule, Rule 13.1. As we did the math on the benefits of Rule 13.1, we determined that the primary benefits from the regulation were going to be derived from reducing methane emissions from refineries. And the primary sources of methane emission at refineries are hydrogen plants and tanks. And so rather than what we've done is we've put Rule 13.1, the general backstop rule, on hold, and then we've moved the resources that we had working on that rule to focus on hydrogen plants. So we think that will get the hydrogen plants rule done more quickly, and we'll get those emission reductions on the books, and then we can pick up the backup rule at a later date. So when Mr. Finkel goes through the rule development efforts today, some of what you will note that backup rule is not in his presentation, and I just want to let you know why. So Jacob is in our rulemaking section, and he has been doing a lot of work on the methane rules, and I will now hand it off to him.
Thank you, Greg. Good morning, Chair Barrett, members of the Climate Protection Committee. My name is Jacob Finkel. I work as a senior air quality specialist in the rule development section. And the purpose of my presentation today is to update the committee on the status of rule development efforts as part of the methane strategy. Oops. So I'll begin the presentation by providing a brief overview of the district's methane strategy, and I'll then briefly discuss the district's methane inventory before moving on to mention the district's organics recovery strategy. Next, I'll update the committee on the status of rule development efforts as part of the methane strategy. Finally, I'll close with an overview on rule development timelines. So the district is regulating methane emissions because methane is a potent greenhouse gas. On a 20-year time scale, it's 86 times more potent than carbon dioxide. And on a 100-year time frame, it's 34 times more potent than carbon dioxide, based on the most recent figures from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The methane strategy is a framework for coordination for all the methane quantification and reduction efforts occurring throughout the district. The district's methane emissions inventory informs research priorities, which guide district-led and contracted monitoring and measurement efforts to continually update the inventory. Emissions inventory staff has developed a tiered approach to identify the underestimated sources of methane by top-down studies. This approach starts by improving emissions estimates at the sector level and facility level, and then focusing in at the source level. Methane emission reduction efforts that comprise the methane strategy span across all district divisions and include regulatory and non-regulatory programs. Regulatory efforts in the methane strategy include rule development, permitting, and enforcement. Non-regulatory efforts in the methane strategy include the development of model ordinances, providing for grants and incentives, and providing educational opportunities, to name a few. Now, staff continues to focus on enhancing its technical expertise and facilitating close collaboration between divisions. So the two columns on this slide present the bottom-up inventory and the top-down inventory of methane emissions in the Bay Area. The bottom-up inventory, which is the smaller column on the left side of the slide, is calculated using the throughput data to generate emissions quantities. The column shows 2015 baseline emissions, which were 10.3 million metric tons carbon dioxide equivalent emissions that year. This amounts to about 10% of all greenhouse gas emissions in the Bay Area. 2015 estimated methane emissions that are displayed on the bottom-up inventory are broken down as follows. Landfills made up 51% of the district's methane emissions. Natural gas facilities, 15%. Sewage treatment plants, 6%. Petroleum refineries, 2%. Others, so non-refinery stationary sources, 7%. Livestock, 15%. On-road mobile, 2%. And wetlands, 3%. Recent national and California studies, however, have indicated large discrepancies between bottom-up and top-down methane emissions inventories due to unaccounted-for emissions in the bottom-up studies. Top-down studies in the Bay Area that estimated methane based on ambient measurements observed methane emissions around 2 times higher than the 2015 bottom-up inventory. These Bay Area studies also attributed most of the missing methane in the 2015 bottom-up inventory to biological sources, with landfills accounting for the largest quantity of emissions. But there are still significant knowledge gaps at the source-specific level, particularly from organic material handling and recovery operations and from refineries. With that precautionary note in mind, the ranges of methane emissions based on top-down studies are as follows. Landfills contribute 50 to 70% of methane emissions in the district. Natural gas pipeline facilities, 15 to 17%. Refineries are anywhere from 2 to 8%. Wastewater treatment plants are currently studied to develop a more precise estimate of that emission quantity. So along with the methane strategy, staff is also implementing an organics recovery strategy. In the context of rule development, the impetus for the organics recovery strategy is as follows. The district's 2017 Clean Air Plan set a goal to divert organics from landfills, as landfills are responsible for at least half of the Bay Area's methane emissions. Senate Bill 1383 mandated a statewide diversion of 50% of organics entering landfills by 2020 and 75% by 2025, using 2014 baseline levels. It also sets a target to reduce statewide methane emissions to 40% below 2013 levels. Achieving a 75% organics diversion by 2025 is expected to bring 12 to 15 large facilities to the Bay Area to process and handle organic materials in the waste stream. The Bay Area is already experiencing the growth of these facilities recovering organic materials, and early adoption of larger scale operations has been difficult. For example, the district has received many odor complaints from the public, emphasizing a need to address the air quality component of organics diversion. This visual shows the current methane rule development efforts and the type of methane emissions addressed, whether they're thermogenic, fossil fuel-based methane emissions, or biogenic or new methane emissions. Staff is focused on addressing the largest sources of methane emissions: landfills and organic material handling and disposal, emissions from refineries, and emissions from natural gas utilities. These sources, taken together, account for over 75% of the district's methane inventory. In addition to developing new rules and amending existing rules to address methane emissions, the district is closely following the California Public Utilities Commission's rulemaking process to achieve reductions in natural gas leaks from CPUC-regulated pipeline facilities. Source-specific rules will address methane emissions, as well as emissions of other climate pollutants, odors, volatile organic compounds, and toxic emissions. The purpose of this slide is to clarify the types and emissions that each rule development effort will strive to reduce. I will discuss each of these rule development efforts in the following slides. Staff is developing a regulation that will serve as a repository of terms, requirements, and test methods for source-specific rules on climate pollutant emissions. Regulation 13 would establish, where necessary, uniform definitions, administrative requirements, monitoring and record-keeping requirements, and test methods that apply to regulating emissions of climate pollutants within the district's jurisdiction. Regulation 13 would provide a foundation from which source-specific rules addressing climate pollutants can be developed and would eliminate the need to make changes to multiple rules when broadly applicable measurement techniques or methods evolve. Staff is developing Regulation 13 with the expectation of amending it as staff develop additional source-specific rules. Staff is in the process of preparing for public workshops on Regulation 13, which are scheduled to take place in mid-June of 2019. Rule 13.2 is a measure by the district to address emissions from current and future increases in organic material handling and composting at new and existing facilities. The Composting in California August 2018 white paper by the California Air Pollution Control Officers Association, CalRecycle, and the Air Resources Board estimates that facilities in the Bay Area will need to process twice the amount of organic material to meet state diversion goals. Increased volumes of organic waste diverted from landfills are overwhelming the capacity of existing composting facilities, resulting in excess methane and volatile organic compound emissions and significant odors from poorly managed composting operations, stockpiles, and other organic waste handling operations. There are currently 20 permanent facilities in the district, but there will likely be need to be 12 to 15 new facilities processing an additional 700 to 900,000 tons of feedstock per year. Staff is developing draft rule 13.2 to provide source-based minimum standards for organic material handling and composting activities and facility-based emissions minimization plan provisions that detail the means of complying with these minimum standards, along with additional best management practices drawn from a menu of options attached to the rule. The draft rule will strengthen compliance and enforcement requirements to prevent excess emissions and ensure consistency in permitting these facilities. Staff is preparing for the second set of public workshops on Rule 13.2 in June 2019 and anticipates proposing the draft rule for board adoption in the fourth quarter of 2019. So, as Greg mentioned, staff is undertaking a rule development effort to reduce methane emissions from hydrogen plants. From top-down methane studies in the methane strategy, staff is aware that hydrogen plant venting may release significant quantities of methane on an event-by-event scale. At hydrogen plants, gas that contains methane is treated to produce hydrogen gas. The final gas product varies from 95 to over 99% hydrogen, which means that hydrogen venting at these plants can include up to 5% methane. Hydrogen is used in refineries to remove contaminants such as sulfur from diesel and gasoline fuels. Gas releases from petroleum refinery hydrogen plant operations are the focus of this rule development effort, which will provide a regulatory basis for requiring these facilities to control methane emissions from these operations. Staff is currently meeting with facility contacts to gain a more thorough understanding of the methane emission inventory from hydrogen plants, as well as the reasons for and the locations of emissions specific to hydrogen plant operations. Staff will soon be touring hydrogen plants at these facilities, and is in the process of determining if hydrogen plant operations are located anywhere else in the Air District outside of petroleum refineries. Staff plans to hold a public workshop in the third quarter of this year and intends to propose the rule to the board for adoption in the first quarter of 2020. Draft Rule 13.4 is a proactive measure by the district to ensure organics are treated properly to minimize emissions of climate pollutants and other air pollutants. The state estimates that statewide, over 12.5 million additional tons per year of organic material will need to be diverted from landfills by 2025 to meet the requirements of SB 1383, and that a significant portion of the diverted material will be handled through anaerobic digestion. Many of the anaerobic digesters in the district are located at sewage treatment plants. The district does not currently have a rule that specifically addresses sewage treatment plant operations or standalone anaerobic digesters. It is envisioned that Rule 13.4 will address methane, volatile organic compounds, and other greenhouse gas emissions from anaerobic digesters in anticipation of increased diversions of organic material. Site visits to various facilities operating anaerobic digesters are planned to take place in the second quarter of 2019. Staff plans to present rule concepts at public workshops in June 2019 and draft rule language at workshops in the fourth quarter of 2019, and a proposal to the board for adoption in the second quarter of 2020. Rule 834 regulates emissions of methane and non-methane organic compounds from landfill surfaces and landfill gas collection and control systems. Through a memorandum of understanding with the Air Resources Board, the district has authority to enforce both Rule 834 and the landfill methane regulation, the Air Resources Board's landfill methane regulation. Amendments to Rule 834 are envisioned to include alignment with current state and federal regulations and best management practices to reduce methane emissions. Staff has been visiting permitted landfill sites in the Bay Area, and field work completed thus far includes compliance testing and methane emissions data collection using the district's research van. At this time, the Rule 834 amendments process is on the same timeline as Draft Rule 13.4. The district's oil and gas rule exempts from regulation methane emissions from facilities subject to it. In July 2017, the Air Resources Board finalized its oil and gas rule, which focuses on reducing methane from high production wells and on preventing significant methane leaks from natural gas storage facilities. The Air District has entered into a memorandum of agreement with the Air Resources Board to enforce the Air Resources Board's oil and gas regulation in the Air District's jurisdiction. Air District staff is assessing whether Rule 837 should be amended to build on and complement the Air Resources Board regulation by extending it to related sources and ensuring toxic air contaminant emissions are minimized. Staff completed data collection as part of a pilot study on methane and toxic emissions from Air District wells. These data are needed to determine the cost effectiveness of the rule and to ensure appropriate measures are included to limit toxic emissions if necessary. Staff is in the process of analyzing the results of the oil and gas study. Staff plans to submit a summary of data collected thus far to the Executive Office to determine next steps in this rule development effort. Depending on the direction provided by the Executive Office, staff plans to hold public workshops on the effort to amend Rule 837 in the third quarter of 2019 and propose amendments to the rule language in the second quarter of 2020 to the board for adoption. The district's methane inventory shows that natural gas facilities account for about 15 to 17% of the district's methane emissions. Senate Bill 1371 directed the California Public Utilities Commission to adopt rules and procedures governing the operation, maintenance, repair, and replacement of commission-regulated gas facilities located in California to minimize hazardous leaks of natural gas and to reduce emissions of natural gas from those facilities to the maximum extent feasible to meet state greenhouse gas targets of reducing methane by 40% by 2030. The Commission has split the SB 1371 rulemaking effort into two phases. The first phase, which was completed in 2017, was designed to develop the overall policies and guidelines for a natural gas leak abatement program consistent with SB 1371. Phase two covers cost effectiveness, further implementation of annual reporting, and the 26 best practices established in phase one, incorporation of phase one rules and procedures into general orders, and evaluating rate-making treatment for lost and unaccounted for gas. District staff continue to participate in Commission and Air Resources Board-led rulemaking to develop natural gas leak abatement programs. The Commission-regulated utilities are parties to this rulemaking and are required to comply with adopted rules and procedures. This table shows each rule, the timing of upcoming workshops, and the estimate of when staff plan to propose draft rules or draft rule amendments to the board. Many of these rules have or will have two sets of public workshops prior to their proposal for adoption by the board. At the first workshop, staff presents draft concepts of new rules or amendments to existing rules. The second workshop, staff presents draft rule language. June workshops for draft rule 13.4 and draft amendments to rule 8.34 will be conceptual. Staff will present draft rule language in those workshops during the fourth quarter of this year. That completes my presentation. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you today. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I'm 1 second. Okay, let's start here.
Thanks for the presentation. I get the impression that controlling methane is, there's a lot of room for improvement. It's a lot of leaky things out there that we can get on top of. When we talk about the organic strategy and compost facilities in particular, are you talking really about just enclosing these things and really controlling the venting? Or are we talking about something more?
Thanks, Director Kim. We're talking about making sure that these facilities use the best practices. Whether that comes up to the point of enclosure is unclear. Typically, if the green waste is handled properly, we don't see a lot of methane emissions from these facilities. It's mainly an issue of when it's not handled properly and goes aerobic in the handling.
So my other question is, landfills are the biggest source of methane. That's pretty clear. How much of that is from these organic compost facilities? How much are compost facilities the problem?
I think when you're seeing methane from landfills, what you're seeing is green waste that's already in the landfills, right? So the green waste that's in the landfills right now is decomposing and turning into methane. The landfills all have capture systems, but they also have these open working faces. And when we do the overflights, that's usually where we see the high methane emissions is from the working face of the landfill. So there are a couple of strategies. One is to put less green waste, less things that can turn into methane into the landfill. I mean, that's the main issue, right? And so that's why we've prioritized the compost rule and the anaerobic digestion rule so high, even though they're not right now particularly high components of the inventory. We want to make sure we've got a good solution for this material so that we can meet these diversion goals without causing more problems than we're fixing. The open working face is something that we're going to have to figure out some methodologies to deal with, and that's why it's taken a little bit longer to get the landfill rule together, even though it is the largest source.
So part of our methane strategy is to try to reduce the amount of green waste that ends up in these landfills?
That's the statewide strategy. We're supporting that as best we can. What we don't want to happen is for that green waste diversion to cause other problems and to end up making the situation worse overall because the material is not being handled correctly.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Director Barrett, I had a question too.
You'll be after two more people.
Thank
you.
Okay, thanks.
So I was kind of zeroing in on the landfills too, and when you show this graph, you know, is who's the culprit? I know that Waste Management out in Livermore, they recover a lot of that methane and they reuse it. Do these graphs take into account that they're actually reusing it to fuel the trucks and things like that?
That's what we're actually measuring from the sky. So, yeah, this is above
sky?
And beyond.
Is that what you said?
Yeah, from the sky.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, this is what's coming out above and beyond what's already being captured. The numbers would be a whole lot worse if we didn't have these systems to capture and use the methane. But under current regulations, the landfills are required to have methodologies in place, including caps and capture systems, to make sure that methane doesn't leak. But even with those systems in place, they're still the largest source of methane.
Okay. And so you referred to the green waste that's in the landfill. And are the landfills still required to use ADC every day? So
yes, under our regulations, yes.
Okay, so isn't that green waste too?
No, because, The stuff that's in the landfills.
I mean, I know it used to be, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So you actually told them to stop, or
The state told them to stop. So the state has put those.
When did they do that?
The first, as Jacob said in his slides, the first requirement was in 2020, and the second requirement is in 2025. 2020 is 50%. 2025 is 75% reduction.
Okay, so I mean, that was my question: is they're still doing it?
There will be still an amount of it going in that's not recoverable. Today.
Yeah, it's not really what I asked, no. But but right now it's business as usual. When it comes to using alternative daily cover, they're still doing it.
No, they've been required to take 50% of the organics out of that. So
they're still doing it.
They are still doing it to a certain extent, yeah.
So why don't we just tell them to stop?
I don't think in reality.
I mean, if we're doing a bad job recovering the methane,
yeah,
and that's the problem.
I don't think we've got one a better solution, and I don't think it's actually possible for them to go 100%, to be quite honest.
Part of the problem is we can't, as an air district, regulate a compost facility.
No, we can't.
No, we can.
No, we can. We can. We just can't regulate odors from composting operations.
Well, what is it we're concerned about?
VOCs, organics, methane, all of those things. Methane, et cetera.
Yeah, so we can control the air emissions, just not the odors themselves.
Right. Well, okay, then I said it wrong. That's a problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it is problematic.
I know that we've talked about several times trying to change that. Have we made any... Is that in our legislative platform to be able to control the odors? Odors, I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't think it's in the current platform. We're working on the wildfire issue, and of course we weigh in when there's legislation on that topic. But the most recent legislation relates to the waste diversion issue. And so the problem we're seeing with that, and I think we spoke a bit about this, is that there aren't enough facilities to deal with the amount of green waste that needs to be diverted. So we're trying to get ahead of the curve as those get developed.
And I think the key point here, Director Haggerty, is that by controlling the methane emissions from these composting facilities through this rule, we indirectly get to the odors because it's the carrier for the odors. So if we can control the emissions from these composting facilities, we get to the odors.
So I guess many years ago we thought we were doing a really good thing with the compost facilities, but in fact they become problematic. Is that really?
If they're well managed, I mean, they work well. But what has happened is because of the volume that's been actually diverted from the landfills now, they're struggling to keep up. So we're seeing more folks come in. They're starting to use different techniques. They're actually forcefully aerating the piles versus turning them. If the facilities are managed, and that's what the purpose of this regulation is to provide best management practices to our facilities. We shouldn't see the issues with methane.
So, and I'm just going to take one more stab, and thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence. But so is the second worst offender, it's a little hard for me to tell here, but is that the wastewater facilities?
I don't believe so. Jacob, wasn't it hydrogen facilities at refineries?
I can go back to the slide. But, well, so from the 2015 inventory, the top-down? Yeah, so from that one, it would be the refineries, but.
I'm sorry. You're right. Okay, so, I mean, yeah, I looked at color. Too much information, but I'm having an optic migraine right now, so it's hard for me to see. But what I would say is, and what I've always said, and maybe because I come from Livermore and I consider them one of the worst offenders when it comes to wastewater treatment. I really believe it's easy to pick on the industry, and it's easy to say you got to change the way you're doing business. But I also believe it's usually government's position to have to show the way that it can be done. And I really think that we shouldn't just be focusing on the private sector, but we should also be focusing on the public sector. And I've said this many times before, but I really believe that the wastewater treatment, I mean, I go by there and they're flaring methane all day, every day, all night, every night. And so I can't believe they're as low as offender as they show here, but I will believe what you're saying, but I also believe we should make them a priority because they're the government and they should show the way. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Director Joya.
Just to look at the schedule again, so do you feel pretty confident with the schedule you've laid out? I know that one of them, just that Rule 13.3 and hydrogen plants is part of the BARCT schedule under AB 617,
no.
Right?
No.
That nope. was not moved up, so that the hydrogen plant was not listed as under the BARCT?
Yeah, this is a methane rule, Director Joya, and
right.
so methane is not...
It's not part of the
it's BARCT. Not regulated under the BARCT framework.
Got it. Okay, but it's a... So... that's right. The other, so there were four, I think, four different rules under the BARCT. The hydrogen was not one of those.
Right. We do have, we're standing up a refinery regulation work group right now.
Right.
And we will be talking about hydrogen plants as well as the refinery BARCT rulemaking in the context of that group.
Right. And do you feel pretty confident or optimistic on maintaining the schedule that you have here?
I would say the further out you see in 2020, the less confident I get.
Right.
I think we've done a lot of work on hydrogen plants right now, so I'm fairly confident of that number.
And these others?
The organic materials, I think we're going to push hard to get that done this year because we have
right.
a lot of issues with that.
And Rule 13, the climate pollutants, isn't a regular – it's more of a definitional rule, it appears, right? It's not really
right.
– doesn't require someone taking action yet. It's more of a more creates the definitions and the structure.
That's accurate.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Ross.
Thank you, Chair. On the composition of the organics, has anybody broken down what I'm sure they have? And what that composition looks like, how much is yard waste and food waste? And I mean, that might be an interesting chart for the full board, if this comes to the full board.
We can come back with an update on the organic material handling strategy and would have that information.
Yeah, what it's comprised of, so we know what we hope to be targeting. And, you know, it just seems from a distant, more distant viewpoint, that the whole jumbled approach here that the state, it's nobody's fault, just the way it is. There should be a more holistic approach than just this sector doing this and this sector doing that. And like Scott said, the public sector is maybe going to do something, but they should be leading the way. There must be other areas in the world that are more proactive in creating a holistic waste stream management protocol, from organics, from food to yard waste. There's got to be somebody that's figured this out in a more cohesive manner and holistic manner. It seems very jumbled, and I can't believe that nobody in the world has figured out a more cohesive and cogent and salient approach to all of this with respect to climate change and methane reduction, along with the other pollutants. I mean, there's got to be somebody else out there. But if there's not, then we get to be the first. But it just seems so haphazard what we're doing here. Maybe we could take a broader view. I know we're doing this the best we can. We're doing a piecemeal view, and I know that we have countervailing authorities and or lack of authority, and it's kind of a jumbled mess. But maybe it should get somehow pulled together in a more grand unified theory than an application than what it looks to be right now. But we shouldn't stop our efforts, but it would be nice if we could get a more holistic approach to it in general, including the state. Thanks.
We can take that back, Director Ross, and take a look and see if there's anybody else out there. There are a couple of national programs in Europe that are probably could be used as models, so let us take a look and maybe we can provide some input to the state of California on their processes as part of their next update.
I have one other question. What's the difference between forcefully turning and forcefully aerating and turning? What is the difference?
So forceful aeration is where a PVC pipe is laid underneath the row, and they actually take an engine and pump air through it to oxygenate it. And then the other way is just turning the rose every couple of days to make sure that there's enough oxygen in there so the rose don't go anaerobic.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So is one better than the other in terms of emissions?
Yeah, I think that the forced aeration is definitely better.
Okay, that's good to know. Thank you, Director Ross. Director Zane?
Yes, thank you. A couple of questions. First, I want to remind us that whenever we are looking at these rules, we need to get a little more into the weeds in terms of public health consequences. So on page 6, there was one reference to slide 6, healthy regional and neighborhood air quality. That's great, but I think that we need to go into a little more detail in terms of why this is a public health initiative, why it's important for the health of the public that we do enforce these new rules, and that we not be shy about that. I feel like sometimes we're a little too shy when we come up with these new rules and enforcement. And maybe it's just because the industries concern us, I don't know. But on the anaerobic digestion side, it's been my experience, and I did a lot of solid waste issues in our county for a number of years, that best technology has it basically produces, and they're being produced in Germany right now, but I think also in Spain, have anaerobic digesters. They're pricey, but they do contain both odors and the methane. They're completely contained. The technology is out there. I think one of the problems is that we have all these individual contractors who not only contract to run our landfills, but also contract to haul solid waste. And as you pointed out several times in your presentation, there's not a consistency. So my question is, with those comments in mind, what else are we doing to assure that the rules be followed not only by the landfill operators, but also by the haulers? And can we say more in terms of our public workshops and presentations on public health consequences or adverse consequences?
Yeah, Director Zane, I think you hit it on the nose. When we're dealing with anaerobic digesting, we have to, what we've been worried about is the in and outs of the facility, what goes in, what comes out. And that's where most of the emissions or the odors or things that we've been concerned about have taken place. A properly run anaerobic digestion system, we don't have any issues with that. But when they have issues, when they have problems or the material handling in and out, that's where we've been having issues. And that's where I think where our rule development will be focusing on.
And can you say a little bit more about the public health consequences?
We'll take that back, Director Zane, when we put the staff report together, and the presentations for the rule will be sure and emphasize the public health benefits of getting these facilities to use the best practices and minimize those emissions, including the VOCs and the odors.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Nutt. I also think that the other thing we need to remember is, because again, I looked at this for so many years, the profit margins in solid waste are incredibly high. This is a very lucrative industry because in the same way we all need to drink water and breathe clean air, we all have waste to dispose of. So let's make sure that our enforcement is going to be significant.
Okay, thank you, Director Zane. Director Nis?
So looking at, good morning, looking at slide 3, which is the one that Scott was discussing, and looking at who is the most either guilty or involved, whatever word you wish to use. As I break this down, this is, I presume you're looking at the whole Bay Area, all of us. What areas are, where do you get the most complaints? In Palo Alto, I don't recall getting any, but I can remember we were concentrating on Milpitas for a while.
Yeah, the most currently the concentrated complaints are in Milpitas and in Richmond.
So it's John's area. So looking at that though, and And now thinking of what Shirley just said around anaerobic, the only anaerobic digester I can think of that's really good sized is in San Jose. Are there others that I just don't happen to know about?
Yeah, I mean, if you go across the Bay Bridge, East Bay Mud, that massive facility there, that's anaerobic digesters. Generally, you know, it's kind of where a lot of wastewater treatment facilities are headed. The larger ones, because the size and scale makes sense, so that's a technology they can implement. On the smaller side, where you don't have the flows, you might not have the amount of organic materials where it makes sense economically to recover that gas. But there are new systems coming online that are making that technology cheaper and cheaper. So that's eventually where we think this will be headed. But right now, it may not be practical from a monetary sense at every single wastewater facility out there.
Thanks. The last question is more right of the moment. Within the last 4 weeks, we've not only had a presentation at our council, there's a huge article yesterday in the San Jose Mercury News about Mountain View, and they just had a workshop on Saturday. And what we're now talking about going in recycling is quite different than it was before. So I almost feel like I've got to relearn the whole thing, because I've certainly recycled a lot that apparently shouldn't be recycled. So when we look at something like that, because this does involve recycling, are we looking at this differently as well? Because when we're talking composting, we're now talking several different ways of combating this. And I know our local public works director has said, we need to start looking at this very differently.
Yeah, I think changes in how we recycle in general will have some impacts here. I think lots of jurisdictions in the United States are struggling with this at the moment, based on the fact that China is no longer accepting a lot of that waste, right? So you can imagine in areas where, you know, it might be a fine line if stuff contains organic material like boxes or milk cartons and things like that, that you could see some of this ending up in the composting stream. So, you know, it's an ongoing discussion. It's something that we're monitoring. We feel, I think, that because of the way that the waste streams are now, this is a succinct enough problem that we can address one stream of it through 13.2 and make emissions reductions, and then we'll just have to continue monitoring it as folks make those changes rolling forward.
I don't know about others. We've closed our landfill, and now to get to a so-called, you know, a dump run on a Saturday is not very common anymore, because you have to drive a fair distance in order to get there. And Shirley, as you mentioned, it's expensive. And I think the closest dump to us in Palo Alto is about $35 and several miles away. So I would think that must also change how we're looking at this whole issue at the same time. Thanks.
Okay, anyone else want a second bite? Okay, seeing. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that, Liz. That was kind of in my list I was going to talk about, because we're also going to have to be rethinking on an individual consumer level how we recycle. And we saw a presentation at our mayor's conference a month or two ago about how basically all they want is the HDPE plastics. The bottle doesn't have a number on it, or it's not a recyclable bottle or can, you know, or clean corrugated cardboard. They don't want it. Putting it in your recycle bin, that's the only thing they pull out. Everything else just goes to trash. So we have a huge rethinking just in that realm as well. So as we're rethinking the waste stream in this realm, I mean, we have to realize that we're going to have to rethink the whole waste stream even quicker on a consumer level. And I've tried to impart that to my household. And, you know, they're still just putting the same old stuff in the recycling bag, and I'm just pulling it out, putting it in the garbage, because that's where it's going to go. Yeah. And, so I think we've got a whole big area that really we're not realizing that we have to re-engineer for our whole society.
And to add one thing to that, our same, the recycling folks that we deal with are now saying they think probably single stream was a mistake and they would change it. But we're so single streamed now, it's going to take a whole new education effort to stop that.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your presentation.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I do have two cards on this item.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Thank you.
Do you want me to call their names?
Yes, please. Okay.
So Jed Holtzman and Bruce Nellis.
Thank you, Chair Barrett and directors. Jed Holtzman from 350 Bay Area. Want to thank staff for all of this work that we've been hearing about for some years now. This kind of systematic multi-sectoral approach is what we need to see, and we obviously support strong rules to robustly reduce emissions from all of these different areas, especially given the wild undercounting that your staff is showing that we're seeing from methane inventory in the Bay Area. I do feel like we often kind of hit the reset button when we walk out of this room, and we kind of only look at what's put in front of us at the given time. And so I want to bring into the room what you've previously heard about these issues. If you could go one slide back, Marcy, to 16, thanks. So just as an example for some of the timing, for Regulation 13, you guys received a presentation in this committee last March that indicated that this would be to the board in 2018. You then received a presentation in September of last year that indicated that this would be brought to the board in early 2019. Now it's the end of 2019. For 13.2, that would be March 2018, then summer 2019, and now the end of 2019. For solid waste, the 2017 Clean Air Plan, which actually got approved in April 2017, had this getting done in 2018. Rule 837, a year ago, 2018, the 2017 Clean Air Plan, 2018. And so what I'm trying to raise by raising these examples is that even with AB 398 taking a tremendous amount of your work plan away from you in terms of what you were promising to do and the amount of rules that you were promising to pass each year, so with a reduced workload, one would expect that the others wouldn't have this kind of timeline slippage. Notwithstanding that they are serious work, you laid out conservative timelines in the 2017 Clean Air Plan, which themselves had already slipped. And so, you know, I think really it would be great if the board would be the holder of oversight over these issues, or the staff, because meeting these timelines in a timely fashion is really incumbent in order for us to meet our key goals. In your cities and counties, I think there's more accountability over timelines for much smaller issues than there are over these huge regional issues that we're looking at here, where things tend to slip when we walk out of the room. I would submit to you that planning without oversight is very much like rules without enforcement, which is to say not worth a lot. And I would really encourage strong oversight over the plans that are presented to you at these committee hearings rather than subject matter conversations. Thank you.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity. My name is Bruce Nellis, excuse me, and I represent Rocky Mountain Institute. My one thought is this is fantastic, but we may want to think about some of this a little more holistically. Natural gas is a huge climate problem across the United States. It today emits more carbon than the burning of coal. For the last 2 years, gas has been right after oil is the biggest climate problem. Gas is 80% methane. And if we think about gas use in California, it is spread between buildings, industry, and the electricity sector. Electricity sector gas is going down with 100% clean energy mandate. Building gas use, we still don't have a comprehensive plan to abate it. When we look at what happens to gas in our homes, a new study from CARB last year found that 0.5% of the gas we use in our homes leaks. And if you think about where does the PUC and the PG&E's jurisdiction end, it ends at the meter. We all live on earthquakes, on an earthquake zone. Every few months, the ground shakes. I live in a 100-year-old house in Oakland. No one has ever inspected the integrity of those pipes. So when we think about how do we solve the methane and the gas problem, it's critical we think about these problems together. There's a great movement afoot to begin to think about a methane-free building. We did a study. It's cheaper to build new methane-free, gas-free buildings than it is to build with gas. So as we're thinking about how do we solve the comprehensive problem of leaks throughout the system, from the wellhead to the burner tip in our basement on the hot water heater, thinking about and making sure when we do our analysis, how much of this methane is actually coming from buildings. I love this presentation, but I actually couldn't answer the question, how much from residential and commercial buildings? And what happens if we do something about that methane use, that gas use in buildings? What does that do to all the upstream reduction in methane? I recognize you don't have jurisdiction over the wellhead in Wyoming. You certainly have jurisdiction over what to do about gas use in buildings. You all regulate hot water heaters. There's a lot we could be doing to thinking about driving down emissions from hot water heaters and begin to think about what are all the benefits of electrifying homes. There's a hearing on Wednesday. Berkeley is thinking about a new ordinance to ban gas in new buildings. That is an awesome methane abatement strategy. How do we begin to think about being a part of that conversation so that we're thinking about the problem holistically and not doing pieces of it when there's an opportunity to think about it all together and we solve both the carbon problem with gas and also the methane use in buildings, which today buildings are oftentimes, in my home city of Oakland, it's the biggest piece we don't know how to fix. So it'd be awesome if we were thinking about how do we, through the air quality lens, help our local jurisdictions also solve the carbon problems, i.e. gas in buildings. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anyone on staff want to address the schedule slippage question that was brought up by the public?
We welcome oversight from the board, and it's important that the public hold us accountable as well. Our focus, however, is on getting rules finalized that are enforceable and make sense from an implementation standpoint. And so that is a lot of what's been driving the extended schedule, especially for the organic material handling and composting rule. The other slippage issue, I think, is with 13.1, which we discovered a lot of sources that we didn't know about through the process of developing 13.1, including the hydrogen plant methane emissions. So I think we're making excellent progress. We continue to lead the state in this effort, and we will get these rules done as quickly as we can. But we want to have quality products that will withstand challenge and that will be practically enforceable on the ground.
Okay, thank you.
And just to make a comment, I appreciate the last speaker was talking about just the larger issues with natural gas. And I know that in this district, when we had discussion about offering funding for folks to replace their wood-burning appliances. And in fact, I remember others were here on this issue advocating and making sure that we would use the funding for those who wanted to replace it with sort of an electric as opposed to natural gas. And I think that's what we did, right? So we did not make, when we were moving people, as we moved people away from wood-burning appliances, the grant funding we had, I thought, was going to be limited to
No, electric.
We had, remember that discussion?
Yeah, we had that discussion. Ultimately, you decided that you would provide grants across the spectrum. So we did provide a low income incentive, and then we provided funding for taking out the fireplace for natural gas inserts and for the electric alternative.
I think we should revisit that. I mean, that we've had this discussion at the California Air Resources Board about funding. You know, there were some proposals, as you know, to put some funding into a natural, sort of gas.
EPA,
right?
Stoves,
and there was more sort of that. We've had this discussion on really pushing more toward you know, jumping over natural gas mm-hmm. as this bridge and putting more of the public investments in mm-hmm. In electric. So I think we should revisit that issue about how we utilize our funding. I mean, realizing that everything's incremental, but if we're going to utilize scarce funding, how do we sort of continue to jumpstart the sort of the more permanent fix we're looking at, which is right, renewable using electricity, renewable electricity as opposed to natural gas.
Yeah, we expect to be bringing you back some changes to that particular regulation and that incentives program later in the year this year. So that we'll tee that up as part of the discussion.
Yeah, I'm in the process of putting solar on my house and then trying to convert all my gas appliances to electric. And it's really hard to figure that out. Yeah. I mean, I know we had talked about being sort of a sort of depository of information for folks looking at doing this. I mean, tankless water heaters are easy, but, you know, electric tankless water heaters, they replacing central heating with gas heating with like electric heat pumps, but it's a really hard space for people to be in and understand. And so I think we could serve as a place to help collect information to help those who make that choice.
I think in the next presentation there's going to be a lot of talk about decarbonizing buildings, and I think that's probably a good segue if we want to.
Well, then let's segue.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. So like we have a systematic method of looking at the sources of methane and identifying strategies to address them, we are similarly in the process of developing a strategy for carbon dioxide. As you may recall, as part of the deal that was struck to extend the cap and trade program, our regulatory authority over carbon dioxide from sources in the cap and trade program was taken away. But we still want to look holistically at all of the carbon dioxide sources in the Bay Area, figure out what are some viable strategies to address it. And the thing that's bubbled to the top that we're putting a lot of effort into is building decarbonization. And so Jacob will walk us through where we are on the carbon dioxide strategy and then get into building decarbonization a bit.
Great. Thank you, Greg. Good morning, Chair Barrett, members of the committee, and happy Earth Day to all of you. As Greg mentioned, my name is Jacob Jelkiewicz, and I'm an advanced projects advisor at the district. And today I'll be providing you with an update on our region-wide carbon dioxide reduction strategy. So I'll start the presentation with some framing material on the Bay Area's carbon dioxide emissions. I'll then provide an overview of some of the exciting work that we're currently undertaking. Next, I'll touch upon ongoing efforts to prioritize additional action to reduce carbon dioxide. And then lastly, I'll talk about next steps. So the pie chart on this page is from the 2017 Clean Air Plan, and that provides the Bay Area's 2015 greenhouse gas emissions profile. That's 85 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. 4% is attributed to methane, and Jacob just mentioned some of the work that's being done to reduce and address that pollutant. And then 4 and 2% respectively is attributed to fluorinated gases and nitrous oxide. The lion's share, or 90% as we see in this chart, is attributed to carbon dioxide, and that's what we're here to talk about today. I'll note that the main source of CO2 is burning of fossil fuels, and the bar chart on the right of the slide depicts the major sources of carbon dioxide emissions in our region by major sectors, so namely stationary sources, transportation, and other area sources such as buildings. So stationary sources are the green shades of the bar chart, and that's a bit more than a third of total CO2 in the Bay Area. It's important to note that a small portion of stationary sources are not subject to the cap and trade program. That's the little light green bar at the very top of that bar chart. While the majority of stationary sources are addressed or are covered by cap and trade. As you'll recall, and you've heard this a few times today, in 2017, the California legislature passed Assembly Bill 398, which prohibits air districts from regulating CO2 emissions from cap sources. We also see that nearly half of all CO2 emissions come from the transportation sector, the majority of which are attributed to non-diesel powered vehicles such as passenger vehicles. The bluish colored bar on the bottom of the bar chart depicts emissions from buildings, so natural gas used for space and water heating. That's about a fifth of total CO2 emissions in our region. And lastly, you can't even see it on the bar chart there, but other area sources, so farming operations, charbroilers, it's a really small portion of our inventory.
Do you have a breakdown between what's residential and what's industrial and commercial, just to get a sense?
The majority, if I recall correctly, is attributed to residential and commercial. I can come back with the specific numbers, though. All right, so moving on to some of the exciting work that we're currently undertaking. So as you'll recall from last year, we launched the $4.5 million climate protection grant program, whereby we provided funding to 17 projects spearheaded by public agencies in the Bay Area. The climate grant projects focus on two categories, or two types of projects: decarbonizing existing buildings and developing innovative strategies with long-term impacts on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Three examples of the grants funding building types of projects are depicted on this slide, and truly they hold potential for replication across the Bay Area and even beyond. So one of the grants is to the San Mateo Housing Endowment and Regional Trust, and that's for low-carbon ADUs, or accessory dwelling units. Specifically, it's a competition to create low-carbon architectural designs that will then be available for the public to use for streamlined ADU permitting. A second set of grants is for heat pump water heaters. Three of our partners are collaborating together to build a regional market for this technology. Specifically, the grant focuses on addressing barriers to greater adoption of energy-efficient heat pump water heaters. And lastly, the City of Brisbane is developing an energy benchmarking ordinance to improve energy efficiency in existing buildings. According to a recent study, and as mentioned by Bruce a few minutes ago perhaps, two-thirds of buildings that will be around or standing in 2045 have already been built. So new construction is being addressed by building code, and there's a lot of work being done on that front, but existing buildings is a big issue. And so in order to achieve our long-term climate targets, more needs to be done to improve the energy and carbon efficiency of our existing stock of buildings. And so the City of Brisbane Energy Benchmarking Project is but one tool that can be replicating by other jurisdictions throughout our region and beyond in order to improve energy efficiency of our existing building stock. And so in addition to funding building projects through our grants program, we're also looking at tackling building decarbonization more broadly, identifying a pathway for the Air District to take in adding value to the building decarbonization space. We're in the midst of a process where we've worked with local government staff to assess their status of moving towards building decarbonization and the type of support, guidance, and tools that they need. Specifically, this included a survey of local government staff, industry experts, and advocacy organizations in order to understand their biggest challenges, the resource gaps, and where they need help. The boxes on the slide shed some light into how we're thinking about our approach towards decarbonization and how the Air District fits in. We want to identify cost-effective actions that have a high GHG reduction potential, that fill a gap and aren't duplicative, but are rather replicable, while also addressing equity and achieving co-benefits. Certainly not an easy task. And lastly, you see the new action areas on the bottom of the slide. Specifically, we're currently working with local government staff and have recently joined the Building Decarbonization Coalition to identify the most helpful policies that we can develop in advance and the pathways to achieving those goals. Also, we've heard loud and clear that local governments need more money, need more resources. So we're assessing potential use of small sums of money for pilot projects around implementation of model policies throughout our region. Lastly, as the Climate Protection Grant Program starts to wrap up over the coming years, we'll be assessing the performance of those projects and identifying areas that are appropriate for replication or for scaling up. Another area where we're working to reduce carbon dioxide emissions is in the transportation sector. So as you'll recall, we launched the Diesel Free by 33 initiative last September when we hosted a day-long Diesel Free by 33 kickoff event in parallel to former Governor Brown's Global Climate Action Summit. We're currently working on the Diesel Free by 33 strategy, and we'll have an update for the board shortly. In addition to Diesel Free, Bear District also has grant revenue, which is invested in programs that drive transportation sector carbon dioxide reductions. You're familiar with many of these programs listed on the slide. The pie chart on the left, or in the top left, shows the percentage of CO2 emissions categorized by mobile and other sectors. So this is the same information that you saw earlier on in the bar chart, but just aggregated by mobile and other sectors. And the table on the right shows the Air District's incentive programs with projected funds for the 2019 calendar year. There's also the type of equipment that the grants fund. So we see much of the funding going towards cleaning up our heavy-duty vehicles, our trucks, also trip reduction, electric vehicles, electric vehicle charging, and additional types of projects. It's important to note that although the primary or original goal of many of the incentives programs is to reduce ozone or particulate matter, it's important to note that in many cases, there are CO2 co-benefits associated with the dollars that are invested. It's also important to note that we're continuing to collaborate with MTC on Plan Bay Area and the Commuter Benefits Program. We're continuing to inform the public about alternatives to single occupancy vehicle trips via the Spare the Air initiative. And we're also working with local governments on best practices for trip reduction. In addition, but also including the transportation and building space, we're also working to accelerate local carbon dioxide reductions across all sectors of the economy. Model ordinances such as the Bay Area Solar PV Ordinance Toolkit was developed in collaboration with the Bay Area Regional Energy Network, or BayREN, and it provides guidance for Bay Area cities and counties that are interested in requiring solar PV. In addition, we're exploring model policies around all-electric new construction and diesel-free transportation. The Air District's Technology Implementation Office has a goal of accelerating climate technologies and has established a financing facility to upgrade technologies and drive greenhouse gas reductions in the Bay Area. Examples of those include grants, low-interest loans, and loan guarantees. For local climate action planning, we're providing guidance and consultation with local jurisdictions as they go through the process of developing or now in some cases updating their climate action plans. This includes review of draft climate action plans, providing feedback and data in certain cases, and convening small groups of local government staff to discuss specific issues, be it inventory matters or transportation strategies, land use approaches. In addition, we're in the process of updating our CEQA guidance and thresholds. And lastly, we're sharing and exchanging information and knowledge with and among local jurisdictions in order to diffuse policy and technology ideas that effectively drive carbon dioxide reductions. This includes webinars, newsletters, and small group discussions around specific topics with subject matter experts. We recognize that although our current actions are contributing to carbon dioxide emissions reductions across the Bay Area, more needs to be done. And in prioritizing which additional actions to take and which clean air plan control measures to tackle next, we're looking at which tools we have at our disposal to tackle emissions from the major CO2 emitting sectors that we've identified. So for rules, we write regulations. For incentives, we provide funding. For local government, we provide support, and for outreach, this includes community engagement, awareness campaigns such as Spare the Air, and work with the legislature through our legislative officer. So what's next? On May 13th, we have a Technology Implementation Office Climate Tech event focusing on building electrification. The intent there is to bring together technology providers, local governments, and people that are interested in the field to network and talk about things that are working, the different types of financing, policy, technology solutions that are available. We're continuing our coordination efforts with BayREN by meeting with them and have recently joined, as I mentioned, the Building Decarbonization Coalition to identify priority model policies. We're also working on the diesel-free program strategy, as I mentioned, which we'll be reporting back to the board on shortly. And lastly, once the climate grant programs start to wrap up, we'll assess and build on the lessons learned. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you. I'd like to open it up for any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the board? Seeing that, is there any public comment? Director Zane, did you have a question?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Public?
Yes, I have Bruce Nellis and Jen Holtzman.
Okay, right. Thank you. I love the story about your experience electrifying your home, and I just went through the process, and I agree. There are not a lot of tools, and in fact, there are a lot of state incentives pushing in the wrong direction. I asked PG&E, can I get help putting in a super efficient heat pump? And they said no, unless it's gas. So right now we have these crazy systems driving us as a default to gas, which may have made sense 2 decades ago, but is actually locking in an enormous amount of fossil fuel infrastructure. New buildings are not being solved. We are finally building a lot of new buildings in the Bay Area, which is great. The notion that we build them all with gas and might have to turn them off in 2 decades to solve our climate crisis is kind of crazy. So anything you can be doing and thinking about the broad scope of your regulatory authority to help push new construction actually being gas-free, methane-free, I would urge be a huge priority. But I wanted to focus on two other health issues, which are squarely in your bailiwick. When I ripped out my gas hot water heater, there was this little sticker on it. It said, certified low NOx by the Bay Area Air Quality Management District. I had no idea that you all regulated water heaters. If you can, it's awesome. If you can regulate NOx, which is obviously a big ozone precursor problem, surely you can get that down to zero and say, no NOx. We still have an ozone problem in the Bay Area. So your regulatory authority to do something about hot water heaters and furnaces, I would say, may be worth a second look. But the most urgent piece, and honestly, I knew nothing about this issue of gas stoves even 6 months ago. Lawrence Berkeley Labs has one of the best indoor air quality programs in the country, a few miles from here. They put out a study 4 years ago that said, on a winter week here in California, when we close our windows and use gas stoves, there are 12 million Californians breathing levels of NO2 that are illegal outdoors. NO2, as you know, is a pollutant we've all regulated for 50 years. We've made enormous progress. There's not a single county in the United States that continues to violate the NO2 standard. The good researchers at LBL say in our kitchens, on a given week when we close our windows, we are violating the NO2 standard. Why have we not addressed this problem? It is a precursor of causes asthma. Huge economic toll. There was a study last year in Australia, in the Australian Medical Journal, said 12.8% of all their asthma costs, and they have a high asthma epidemic like in the United States, 12.8% of the asthma epidemic in Australia can be attributable to gas stoves in people's homes. We're making our buildings tighter, which is awesome from an efficiency perspective, but squarely in that mix is this health issue and a huge equity issue, because the smaller the home, the worse the pollution, and thank older homes you. Don't have extraction devices. Thank you.
Thank you again, Chair Barrett. Jed Holtzman from 350 Bay Area. Thank you to the staff again. This is, you know, the kind of systematic approach that we need to see in order to actually you know, address a very complicated pollutant, and we're very interested in seeing all of these next steps. If you could go back one, Marcy. I think the major point that we would want to make is that we need to take, and I think it really squares with what the last speaker said, we really need to take bigger bites out of this, especially at this very late date. As far as, you know, I think one of the elephants in the room is the lack of a dark green dot there in the second row, which is a result of AB 398. And as a result of that chunk of rulemaking being taken out of your quiver, I think we really need to look really assiduously at what we can do even outside of your normal regulatory authority in all of those other areas. For example, again, as the last speaker highlighted, and as we've mentioned many times over the last 5 years or so, as far as buildings are concerned, it is within your power to set a future effective date to phase out fossil fuel use for space and water heating, i.e. to say that as of year X, you know, furnaces and burners of the normal variety will no longer be allowed in new construction within the region. That would send a market signal that would also prevent the installation of natural gas infrastructure that will be used for 30 to 50 more years when we can't be really doing that or shouldn't be really doing that. So I think we should look at what we can do with respect to buildings beyond what we are already doing with the Building Decarbonization Coalition. Also looking at transportation, you know, I think that we need to look much more assiduously at what you can do with MTC and CARB to instill in certain aspects of their organizations the leadership on climate that you guys have taken on with respect to vision setting and planning. So with respect to transportation planning and also maximizing the CO2 co-benefits of the transportation incentive and grant money that is being spent, that's not being done. For example, you know, about 95% of your incentive funding for wood smoke is going to natural gas, to Commissioner Joya's point. About 95% of your incentive money that we're spending, our money, is going to replace wood smoke with natural gas. So is your transportation money being best spent? Is that money being best spent to reduce CO2 to the maximum extent possible? I don't know. I think that we need to be looking at that. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Director Haggerty?
So the first speaker was talking about gas. Is the reason PG&E is saying that is because they don't, the CCAs don't control gas, and therefore they're trying to move people to that, so that way they can keep their revenue stream going, and they're not really caring about the environment.
Well, we know
why
that
they care.
But we know that for CCAs, that a large portion of their business plan is to target sources of natural gas and to move them on to electricity. We've heard that in our conversations with them. That's about all I could say on that particular topic. But, you know, the idea that more and more of these processes, industrial processes and others, are going to tend towards electric is dependent on the rate structure. Because right now that's the largest component of the issue for industrial sources. Demand charges are killing that transition. So there's definitely some work to be done there by the CPUC and the CEC on that particular issue.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And did you want to respond?
No, I'm not sure what he said.
Okay, well.
I'll talk to him offline.
Thank you. Okay, so let's, okay.
So, yeah, just to get back this idea, our when we put the toolkit together on solar, I think when we do model ordinances, we can play a major role. And likewise, you know, given that with the California Energy Commission's requiring, in 2020, all new single-family residential to have solar, and it seems that would be sort of the opportunity to link the requirement of all electric appliances, because then the homes are built or sized to address the load of all electric appliances. Have we looked at that issue, our ability to, and maybe sort of leadership working, we probably can't require, this is something that would have to be done probably through the building code, through the amendment of the state building code, working also with cities and counties that actually implement the building code at the local level?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's a little bit of an overlap, right? We can regulate stationary sources, which we have standards on water heaters and space heaters. So that can be done, but the ultimate question of electrifying buildings and all that sort of thing falls to the state architect and ultimately to local government modifying the state building code.
This is where we could also play some leadership role with regard to, we've done this with solar, so in the Bay Area, if we're working with city and county government for amending their local building codes to require that for new homes, for example, that are installing solar, so that then the house is you know, the whole solar electrical panel is sized to meet the load of all electric appliances.
Right, and there's a range of those kind of activities, making sure that the wiring is in place, and same thing for electric vehicle charging. All of those play into electrifying these sectors.
Yeah, as we've seen, as the gentleman here talked about his own, I mean, I've just in going through, you know, I have an electric car, if you're going to convert gas appliances to electric, you have major increases to your electrical panel, which are more expensive to do after the fact than they are when the house is built,
right
for new construction. Right.
Right.
And I think getting back to this idea that I mentioned earlier of also how I think we're successful when we're also a resource for those who wish to do this on their own and to help them and empower them and to collect information. And that would be good to add to our task list for us to have a toolkit available, a resource base for city and county government and for individuals.
Right. Yep. Those clearinghouses can be very valuable.
Factor in the clearinghouse so we're not just talking about it? What's your sense, Greg, of where that adds in this chart?
Maybe Abby could give us some more detail on her work plan with respect to...
And really working with Bayren's great to work with, because I mean Bayren really is the entree with local governments, and they are, I mean, rather recreate the wheel with different agencies doing the same thing. Bayren is a good sort of central place and working with them.
That's right. And we work with Bayren very closely on a very regular basis. We've integrated with a lot of their codes and standards work. We are talking with them through part of this process that Jacob mentioned, where we are figuring out what is the role of the air district? What are the next things we need to do in 2019 to support local governments accelerating their pathway toward decarbonizing their existing building stock? And a lot of the ideas that the member of the public, Bruce Nillis, mentioned, we've met with Bruce as well, are things that we are discussing directly with local government staff as well as other subject matter experts. So I think in this slide, a lot of these tools, we're trying to bring all of these tools to bear on how we can affect building decarbonization. So we're still in kind of the final phases of figuring out what our appropriate role is, but very quickly moving now into implementing the next projects.
Okay, are you over? Mm-hmm. All right, good. Okay, thank you. So we'll move on to the next item, which is the update on Community Choice Energy Study.
Director Barrett.
Yes.
I apologize. We've had a really good discussion on the methane strategy and the CO2 strategy with the Finance Committee meeting. We're concerned about having enough time to complete the action items of that committee. So the staff would like to suggest that we bring this item back for a different committee meeting.
Okay.
Finance,
what time is their meeting? Was supposed to start at 10:30?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so maybe we should look at how we're scheduling meetings.
Right.
Because I actually think that this is an important meeting, and it's unfortunate that we're going to have to postpone this.
If the committee would prefer to proceed, we're certainly ready to proceed.
If they have action items that, you know, I don't believe we do have action items.
That is our concern.
But I'm just saying that in the future, we should take that into consideration, because I don't want to cut discussion off at this committee because of bad scheduling.
Yeah, you only took an hour for finding it.
Okay, so I apologize, Abby, but do we need a vote of the committee, or we're just going to, at the call of the chair, we're going to recess this meeting until our next meeting, or we're going to adjourn it?
I think you can adjourn it. We'll simply put it on the agenda for another meeting.
Or will you be pulling the committee as soon as possible to set up another meeting? Yes.
I believe our May 16th meeting was canceled, so are we going to reinstate that meeting?
May 16th of this committee?
We can work with the chair to schedule another meeting.
So, I mean, I'll work with staff to do that.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I don't know if May 16th works for everybody else either, because when you cancel a meeting, other people, things come in.
Yeah. That's
what it usually happens. Yeah, well, we'll see. Okay. We'll find out. So I guess the meeting is adjourned so that the Finance Committee can meet.
So thank you.
You only scheduled an hour for this meeting?
Yeah.
They only scheduled an hour for this meeting?
No, I don't.
That's not.
I mean, I knew it was happening, but I just don't.
Yeah.